There are seasons in life when a question arrives at the worst possible time. Right in the middle of fear, right in the middle of anxiety, right in the middle of exhaustion. I remember a time when I was carrying way more than I can name, moving through a week that was heavy, heavy from all directions. Someone looked at me, saw the strain across my face, and that I thought, of course, that I was hiding so well, and asked a simple but piercing question: "Are you okay?" It wasn't a casual question. It was one of those questions that kind of stop you because you know the person isn't asking for a polite answer. "Oh, I'm fine, thank you." They're asking for the truth. And the truth feels risky when you're standing in a hard place. Questions asked in moments of challenge have a way of revealing what's really happening inside us. They pull us out of autopilot. They ask us to be honest. They ask us to choose what voice we will listen to. Jesus does something similar with his disciples. He doesn't ask his defining question in a quiet moment, oh no, or a comfortable place. He asks them in Caesarea Philippi, a region filled with temples, idols, and symbols of political power, a place where loyalties are divided, identities are contested. It is a landscape of competing voices, each claiming authority over their lives. And right there, in the middle of the noise, Jesus asks the question that cuts through everything else: "Who do you say I am?" He asks it in a place where fear, confusion, and pressure are real. He asks it where other questions are loud. He asks it where the disciples must choose what voice they trust. Jesus still asks us questions in the hard places, where life is crowded, when fear is so close, when we feel pulled in so many directions, not to expose us, but rather to anchor us, not to shame us, but to steady us, not to overwhelm us, but to remind us of who he is and whose we are. This is where the story begins, with the question asked in a place of challenge, inviting us to speak from the truth within us. Just as questions often find us in moments of strain, Jesus' question finds the disciples in a season where they are carrying more than they can understand. By the time they reach Caesarea Philippi, they have witnessed astonishing miracles, they have witnessed healing, they have witnessed feeding, they have witnessed a strong storm being calmed by a simple word. They have seen Jesus' compassion for the crowds and his boldness with the religious leaders. They have watched him restore the broken and confront the powerful. They're not in a great place. And yet, they're also confused. They have seen Jesus rejected by the very people who should have recognized him. They have watched the Pharisees and the Sadducees demand signs, not because they want to believe, but because they want to trap him. They have heard Jesus warn them about the yeast of their leaders, about teaching that distorted faith and burdens the soul. They have even misunderstood his warnings, thinking he was talking about bread, only to realize he was speaking about spiritual blindness. The disciples are walking with Jesus, but they are still trying to make sense of him. They know he is more than a teacher. They know he carries authority that cannot be explained. They know he is leading them somewhere, but they do not understand where or why. Beneath all that, a quiet tension remains. If Jesus is who he seems to be, everything in their lives will change. So when Jesus brings them to Caesarea Philippi, a place filled with idols, temples, and symbols of earthly power, the disciples carry a mix of awe, uncertainty, hope, and fear all at the same time. They have seen enough to believe, but not enough to understand. They are following faithfully, but they are still wrestling internally. Into that emotional landscape, confusion, pressure, expectations, and longing, Jesus asks his questions, not to expose their uncertainty, but to draw out the truth that God has been planting in them all along. This is why the moment matters. Jesus doesn't ask the question when the disciples feel strong. He asks it when they feel stretched. He asks it when they are unsure. And he asks it when the world around them is loud, loud with other claims. Because it is often in those very moments when life is crowded, when fear is close, when faith feels so very fragile, the truth of who Jesus is becomes clearest. There's a certain ease in talking about what others believe. It keeps us safe. It keeps us unexposed. When Jesus says, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" the disciples answer without hesitation. They repeat what they have heard prophets and teachers and miracle workers say, all responsible answers, all answers that stay at arm's length. Fred Craddock once said that borrowed answers are the ones we can speak without our voice trembling. They are tidy, they are familiar, and cost us nothing. They let us stay in the realm of observation rather than confession. But Jesus does not leave the question there. Oh no. He turns it. He narrows it down. He brings it close enough to touch it. Who do you say that I am? Now, the question is no longer about political opinion. No, it is no longer about what the crowd thinks or what traditions they have been handed down. It is about the truth that lives inside each disciple, the truth shaped by walking with Jesus, listening to him, watching him, and trusting him. Craddock would say this is the moment when the sermon moves from the porch to the living room. The moment when the question stops being informational and becomes relational. The moment when Jesus is no longer asking for a definition, but a declaration. Faith is never built on what they say. Faith is built on what you say, what you have come to know of Christ. In your story, in your struggle, in your hope, in your lived experience of grace. This is the invitation to the passage, to move from second-hand faith to first-hand revelation, from repeating what others believe and naming what Christ has become in your own life. Jesus still asks that question to us, not to corner us, not to call us, not to test us, but to draw us deeper. Not to measure us, but rather to meet us. And the answer, your answer, shapes the very heart of your faith. Peter steps forward with a bold, Spirit-given clarity, and he says, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Jesus affirms that this insight didn't rise from Peter's own reasoning. No, God revealed it in Peter. Revelation always comes from responsibility. We come to know Christ not by our intellect alone, but by the truth God plants in our willing hearts. Jesus then declares that this confession, the revealed truth, is the rock on which he will build his church, not Peter's perfection, not the disciples' strength, not our ability to get everything right. The foundation is Christ himself that the church is built on. Christ himself, known and confessed. And because the church is built on Christ, Jesus says, the gates of Hades will not prevail. In the ancient world, gates symbolized a city power with boundaries, its ability to find itself and have great influence. Hades represents death. It represents destruction and all forces that oppose God's living, life-giving work. Jesus is saying that no power of death, no power of evil, no chaos or darkness, no overpower can overpower what God establishes. The church is built on a foundation that cannot be undone. The church's resilience has never depended on flawless people. It has always depended on faithful people. Faithful Christ, revealed, confessed, and unshakable. When Jesus speaks of giving Peter the keys to the kingdom, he is not handing over a literal set of jingly keys. In the ancient world, keys symbolize trust, responsibility, and a delegated authority. The one who held the keys was the steward, the person entrusted to open what should be opened and close what should remain closed. It is a role rooted in discernment and care. Jesus entrusts this symbolic authority to Peter, undeniably imperfect disciple that he was. And can we not forget just for a moment what we already know? See, this is the same Peter who will deny Jesus 3 times. But he gives them the keys to the kingdom. The one who is bold in confession will also be fragile in fear. His future failure does not cancel his calling. It reveals the depths of Jesus' trust and Jesus' grace. Jesus gives authority to someone who will stumble, just like us. Because the foundation of the church is Christ's faithfulness. It's not Peter's faithfulness. Bidding and losing reflects the work of guiding and shaping the community of faith. Teaching what leads to life, releasing what burdens the soul, and help people's God discern the way of Christ. It is the sacred work of stewardship, not control, but service, not superiority. And this authority is not limited to Peter alone. Oh, no. It extends to all who confess Jesus with sincerity and courage. Every believer carries a measure of spirituality, spiritual authority rooted in their confession of Jesus, authority to bless, to encourage, to open doors to God's life, and to help release burdens that keep people from flourishing. Our confession does not just name who Christ is. It invites us into the responsibility of living that truth for the sake of others, even in our imperfections, even in our moments of weakness, just like Peter. Right after Peter's confession, Jesus begins to speak of suffering, sacrifice, and the cost of the road ahead. Revelation always leads to mission. Once you see who Christ truly is, you cannot remain unchanged. Confessing Christ means following Christ, even when the path is demanding, even when it leads through places of loss, of sorrow, even when it asks us to surrender what we once held tightly. Richard Nouwen often wrote that true identity is discovered not in comfort, but in calling, when we dare to follow Jesus into the places where love becomes costly and obedience becomes real. The disciples must learn that messiahship is not triumph without sacrifice, but love, willing to bear the weight of the world. This is the turning point of our passage. Once we know who Jesus is, you must decide who you will be in response. And Jesus still asks the same questions today. Not, who does your family say I am? Not, who does your church say I am? Not, who do the experts or the crowds say that I am? Oh no, it's your voice. Your voice, your story, your lived truth. Because your answer shapes everything. It shapes your identity. It shapes your purpose. It shapes your calling. The way you move through joy and the way you move through sorrow. And the way that you understand what God is doing in you and through you. Nouwen reminds us that Christ's question is not meant to judge us, but to draw us into a deeper intimacy with Christ. It invites us to live from the center of who we are and who we are becoming in God. This, my friends, is the heart of the gospel. To let the revelation of Christ become the direction of your life. To let confession become calling. To let your answer to Jesus' question shape the person you are and the person that you are becoming. He, Christ, is still asking, and your answer still matters. Amen.